This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, March 4th. We're just 3 weeks to spring. I'm Dave Benninger. Glad to have you joining us. Coming up this week, we'll get reaction from the recent Board of Fish meeting, which didn't go the way some in Bristol Bay were hoping.
My biggest disappointment was, quite frankly, that the majority of the board kind of picked and chose the science that they wanted to observe.
The Iditarod race has its ceremonial start tomorrow. APRN's reporter on the trail offers a preview. Pediatric specialists in Alaska are lobbying for early childhood intervention programs. They were in Dillingham this week talking about the lifetime of effects that come from traumatic or adverse experiences during childhood.
Anything you can think of that's a chronic health condition as an adult has been linked back to these adverse childhood experiences.
Plus, this week we'll go behind the scenes with Bumua and learn about a way biologists will be trying to count moose populations without the backdrop of snow to see them by.
We know we're missing moose, and so what we're trying to do is estimate how many we're missing. So if we know how many we're missing plus how many we've actually counted, then we have a total population.
Those stories are coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. Alaska Republicans turned out in record numbers to weigh in on the presidential candidates on Super Tuesday. By a 2% margin, Ted Cruz edged out GOP frontrunner Donald Trump in Alaska. Nearly 22,000 registered Republicans went to the polls. The previous record was 14,100. State Republican Party Chair Peter Goldberg says acute dissatisfaction with the Obama administration is sparking enthusiasm here in the 49th state.
We're tired of the federal overreach. We're tired of the disdain that Barack Obama has had for the military.
District 37 Republicans voting at Dolly's Hall in Naknek Tuesday also favored Cruz over Trump by just 4 votes. Alaska Democrats will caucus on March 26th. A Superior Court judge ruled in favor of Governor Bill Walker this week in a challenge to his Medicaid expansion. The Republican-led legislative council sued last summer to stop Walker from unilaterally expanding Medicaid. The case is likely to go now to the state Supreme Court. Democrats hailed the ruling and criticized Republicans for the hundreds of thousands of dollars spent battling the case. Alaskans from around the state have been providing testimony to the House Finance Committee this week, which has cut $145 million more out of the operating budget than the version proposed by Governor Bill Walker. Only a handful or more from Bristol Bay spoke up during opportunities to testify this week. Among them was Alana Hurley, speaking on behalf of the United Tribes of Bristol Bay. Hurley spoke against cuts to rural programs and against limiting the size of permanent fund dividend checks.
For example, the proposed cuts slated for our DA's office, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, our elders longevity bonus, the state troopers, the Department of Fish and Game, closing our rural schools, and most significantly the cuts to the permanent fund dividends will all disproportionately affect members of our rural villages. In the quest for more budget cuts, the legislature seems intent on slashing all the services that rural Alaskans depend on most and have a right to as citizens of this state. These proposed cuts will harm rural Alaska's most vulnerable citizens.
The House Finance Committee took some 20 hours of testimony over 4 days. The Senate Finance Subcommittees are beginning to finish their versions of agency budgets this week. The Department of Fish and Game has opened a special caribou hunt in portions of GMU 17A and C, attempting to allow to harvest Nooshigak Peninsula caribou that are straying north from their traditional range. Neil Barton is the area wildlife biologist with the Fish and Game Office in Dillingham.
The reason we're opening the hunt is some of the caribou from the Nooshigak Peninsula are kind of dispersing a little bit to the north and maybe a little to the east, so they're coming out of that federal hunt area into an area that we don't even have an open hunt in right now. So to make those caribou available to hunters, especially in the Manicotic area and maybe some folks from Dillingham heading west, we're opening the state hunt, which makes those animals available for harvest.
Permits are available now, and the hunt opens today through the end of the month. Hunters can take up to 2 caribou of either sex. The village of Igiagig announced this week that it had been awarded nearly $400,000 to continue advancing its in-river hydropower system they hope will eventually displace the use of diesel entirely. After 2 successful summer tests in the Quijack River, Village Administrator Alexander Salmon says there are a few more tweaks and tests that need to happen, including analyzing the system's effects on out-migrating smolt.
The device was installed at the peak of the sockeye salmon return last summer, and over 1 million swam by it, and there was no harm to fish. So we know that the adult salmon are are in the clear. So this would be focusing on outmigrating salmon smolt and ice formation and movement.
The recent grant comes from the U.S. Department of Energy. The third round of testing is scheduled to begin this summer. And after reporting a net loss of $23 billion in 2015, oil and gas company Apache Corporation announced it will be pulling out of Alaska. The company is one of the largest leaseholders in Cook Inlet, where it has been exploring for oil since 2010. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Earlier this week, the State Board of Fish wrapped up its meeting on Alaska Peninsula, Aleutian Island, and Chignik fisheries issues. A number of Bristol Bay stakeholders attended that meeting, in large part to attempt to push back against what they feel is Area M's fishermen's interception of Bristol Bay bound salmon, primarily at outer Port Hyden. Our reporter Molly Dishner has been covering the outcomes of the meeting, but for some commentary and reaction, I'm joined by Norm Van Vactor, who is the president and CEO of the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation. BBEDC funded travel for a number of people to have good representation at the meeting. As the dust settled, Van Vactor said there's no two ways about it. Bristol Bay interest took this meeting on the chin.
I think for the most part, a lot of us had felt that for a long time there had been somewhat of a compromise in some of the fish politics between Area M and Bristol Bay. But that compromise was unrooted in 2007.
When
there was a significant increase in fishing area and fishing time. And our number one hope, I guess, was that we could reverse that. Not take more, but reverse that decision that was made in 2007. The one proposal that everybody was very, very strong about was the proposal about the inner and outer Port Hyden area. Proposals, I should say. And at the end of the day, our hope was that nobody fished there, that it was a takeaway from Bristol Bay in 2007, and we felt the logical compromise was that we just close those waters. Since we didn't know what was going on there, since we knew for certain it wasn't being managed by a salmon management plan, it wasn't speaking to meshic escapement at all, we felt that the logical solution was that nobody fished there. And not only did the board say Area M could, but then they turned around and expanded the area even further.
That's tough.
So that was very disappointing.
The University of Washington's Fisheries Research Institute conducted a new study about the fish caught in the open area of outer Port Hyden. The study's lead, Chris Boatwright, traveled to Anchorage during the meeting to present the findings. Van Vactor says that study showed what Bristol Bay has long argued, that the fish caught there by the Area M fleet are by and large bound for Bristol Bay's rivers.
We didn't want to just go in there with emotions. It was a very complete and a very robust study. And it demonstrated very, very clearly and reinforced WASIP that at the end of the day, on average, close to 90% of the fish in that area were Bristol Bay bound. And quite frankly, it also demonstrated very clearly that as you move farther north from Ilnik through outer Port Hyden and up, that percentage increased even further. It also demonstrated very clearly that the composition of the fish close to shore and offshore were virtually identical. And I think my biggest disappointment was, quite frankly, that the majority of the board kind of picked and chose the science that they wanted to observe. And they basically took the science that said the composition was the same close to shore and offshore and used that, and then completely ignored the fact that the vast preponderance of these fish were Bristol Bay destined. And that was very, very disappointing. And if I could just elaborate on that point a little bit, again, it's seven board members. It just felt, and I think the votes demonstrated, that there were three board members that were very clearly in support of expanding intercept fisheries, whether it was on the North Peninsula or elsewhere. There were three that took conservation and destination of origin at heart to heart. And then there was one individual who kind of went both ways, but when it came to some of the key decisions anyway, kind of went along with expanding intercept fisheries.
With its delegation of stakeholders, its paid consultant, and the findings from the genetic study that it commissioned, BBEDC added a noticeably large and aggressive presence to a Board of Fish meeting focused primarily on other fishing grounds. We heard from some that the board members seemed to tire a bit of the Bristol Bay lobby. I asked Van Vactor if BBDC's strategy was flawed at all by its intensity.
No, I don't think the overall strategy and the overall work that we're collectively doing is losing its importance. I think that I had a sense anyway that for some of the board members, they felt, what's Bristol Bay doing at a North Peninsula meeting? They had their time in the sun
right. A
couple months ago. Why are they here again? And what I guess we couldn't convince them of was that what happens in Area M is extremely important, not just to the people in the communities of Bristol Bay, but the communities on the Yukon and the Kuskokwim and the folks in Chignik and elsewhere. But there was definitely a sense of bias, I hate to use that word, against us.
We heard about some behind-the-scenes meetings, effort to get some cooperation. Did you leave with the sense that Area M and Bristol Bay are further apart or closer together and their ability to negotiate and foster some diplomatic solutions?
Further apart is my sense right now. That's not to say that can't be rectified. I think the job for a lot of us is to, again, talk to all the affected communities. Quite frankly, I think that the folks, you know, up north, the folks in Bristol Bay, the folks in Chignik, the folks in King Cove and Sand Point, we do share a tremendous number of interests. I think it's very unfortunate that this additional fish grab, if you will, that's taken place on the part of just a few fishermen on the North Peninsula will negatively impact our overall relationship. I'm convinced that we'll build on that relationship and that when we get back together this next time, that there will be a broader coalition that will in fact consist of people from Area M who are like-minded, again, who could do better.
Okay. Yeah. Norm Van Vactor is the president and CEO of the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation. Norm, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
We'll have more from that interview, including Van Vactor's take on Governor Walker's decision not to renominate Fritz Johnson or any other Bristol Bay resident to the Board of Fish, posted at our website. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, back in a moment. A group of pediatric specialists were in Dillingham this week talking about adverse effects during childhood and how those can lead to a number of health problems for the rest of people's lives. Beyond that, they are trying to show that money spent intervening early in a child's life can save a number of treatment costs more expensive well down the road. Yesterday, we were joined by one of their delegation for more about ACEs.
My name is Matt Hirschfeld, and I'm a pediatrician at Alaska Native Medical Center, and I'm on the board for the All-Alaska Pediatric Partnership.
Dr. Matt, thanks for coming in the studio.
Thanks.
Tell me what ACEs is.
It's a short acronym for Adverse Childhood Experiences, which is basically 10 things that can happen to you when you're a kid that can cause some pretty significant health problems throughout your life.
What are some of the items on that list?
So a kid who's witnessed domestic violence, a kid who's been a subject of physical or sexual abuse, if there was substance abuse in the house, incarcerated family members, there's a list of 10 things that are pretty significant like that.
Now, roughly 20 years of data shows that these traumatic events in childhood lead towards what?
They actually lead to bad health outcomes as adult, as older kids, in essentially every organ system in the body, including heart disease, increased risk of suicide and other mental health problems, problems with pregnancy, problems with arthritis, problems with your immune system, cancer, essentially anything you can think of that's a chronic health condition as an adult has been linked back to these adverse childhood experiences.
Why exactly? It's stress-related, right?
It is stress-related. And so kids who have had these things happen to them don't really learn how to handle stress very well. And so if they are repeatedly exposed to these, they are essentially under constant wear and tear from a stress standpoint. And when you're like that, that puts your body at increased risk for having all sorts of health problems when you're older.
Part of the messages you bring is that prevention is the key to these health effects later in life. It's not just about solving an issue in a family now at the moment or something. This is about creating healthier outcomes 20 or 30 years down the road.
That's right. This is all about public health, and it's all about population health. And so our goal as the Alaska Pediatric Partnership is really to try and make Alaska's population healthier by decreasing our ACEs score as a population.
How do you do that?
Well, so there's lots of ways to do that. And essentially, the best way to do it is anybody who comes in contact with families. So this is schools, this is providers, this is healthcare professionals. Anybody who comes in contact with families, you should be prepared to have these discussions with families and screen families for bad things happening at home. And if we can identify families where bad things are happening and then get them the help they need, especially if they have young kids, we will interrupt this generational trauma that's happening, and those kids will be able to develop to their full potential as opposed to if we don't get them the help.
Now, getting them the help usually requires programs or personnel, and we don't have a lot of money. How do you convince people who control our funding that these are important projects to undertake?
Well, we have great data, and this was all generated by a guy named Pat Sidmore, who's down in Juneau. And we have great data showing that if we are able to decrease ACEs in Alaska, how much money we would actually save. So let's say we decreased our adverse childhood experiences score as a population by 0.5 point, which is a very small change. We'll actually save about $90 million per year in Alaska. And so trying to talk to legislators about that, that's a very compelling argument because that we are in such a fiscal crisis at this point.
Give me an example on how that money savings happens down the road.
Sure. So if you have had a adverse childhood experience as a child, you're much more likely to be on Medicaid as an adult. And so if we can decrease our adverse childhood experiences score for the state of Alaska, we can decrease the number of people on Medicaid, and that saves the state all sorts of money. Medicaid's big in the news right now. We're trying to reform it because it is one of the most expensive things that the state budget has. So if we can decrease the number of people on it, we'll be able to decrease the cost of Medicaid for the state significantly.
Something else that you talk about in your presentation is the effectiveness of earlier intervention. Mm-hmm. It's more receptive, or perhaps you could explain.
Sure. So younger children's brains are much more pliable than older people's brains. You kind of become set in your ways as you get older. And so if you can affect change on a kid less than three, you'll have a much bigger change in their ability to handle stress, their ability to deal with stressful events, than if you try and target somebody at 15 when all those stressful events have already caused big brain changes. The brain's capacity to change in kids less than three is much bigger than when you're 15, 8, 30, 40. And so really what we want to do is we want to target families who have young children with great programs to get those families help so that those kids can develop normally.
But conversely, I think as a society, we're spending more on people later on when they're less receptive to some of these perhaps intervention methods.
That's correct. It goes back to your prevention question from a couple questions ago. We want to prevent kids having to enter juvenile justice and the court systems and all those kind of things. Those are the expensive things that we can prevent by targeting kids when they're much younger and families who have kids when they're much younger. There's a couple of good graphs in my presentation that show if you your rate of return, which is if you plug a certain dollar amount into a kid less than three, you get much more out of that dollar than if you plug that same dollar amount into a 20-year-old or a 15-year-old, because their brains just have this great capacity to change, and you can really make them much healthier, easier as a younger kid than an older kid.
Doctor, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Again, that was Dr. Matt Hirschfeld, a pediatric specialist with the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. The Inuit soul group Bumua returned to Dillingham for a free concert last night. Here's a short sample. Bumua's visit coincided with a youth leadership symposium that drew high school students from about half a dozen communities around Bristol Bay. The students had the chance to workshop music and culture with the veteran Bumua performers. KDLG's Hannah Colton takes us behind the scenes.
Before the start of the workshop, Philip Blanchett moved a couple tables out of the way in the long conference room. Blanchett is a singer, dancer, and drummer in the group Bumua. He had everyone sit down in a big circle on the floor, leaving enough room in the middle for when he had to jump up and demonstrate some Yupik dancing moves every few minutes.
Yeah, that one's a good one. I like that one. So I have it right now is my favorite.
Blanchett spoke for nearly an hour, mostly about how he relates to his Yupik culture, but it was far from a lecture. He cracked jokes.
Talk with you guys a little bit about abstinence only. Really, no, I'm just kidding. We're not going to talk about politics or religion.
He told stories about growing up doing subsistence in Bethel. He described the first time he ever saw Yupik dancing on KYUK television when he was about 5 years old.
And I just remember I could still feel it. I like felt like goofy doing it, but I knew that I, even though I wasn't good at it at that moment, I knew that I would be able to do it. I was like, and I laughed, and I giggled, and I was like, all right. I remember thinking, okay, I could do that.
Blanchett has that rare ability to talk to young people about serious things without talking down to them. Everyone was captivated, from the shyest teenager to the campus staff to the elders looking on. But Blanchett made it clear that his real audience is the kids.
Because when you pretty soon in a couple of years you guys are going to be in control of your own life, making your own decisions, and you're going to need the community, you're going to need your people, the people are going to help you out, the people that you're going to help. Well, the Native community, through the games and then Native dancing in the schools and the dance programs, all those things, those opportunities, are exactly what encouraged me to do what I do today.
There's a big challenge that Blanchett sees, which is that a lot of those cultural connections are getting lost between the generations. At one point, he asked the high schoolers, who here speaks Yupik? Only one hand went up.
I'm Mackenzie Nanaluk, and I'm in 10th grade. I'm from Manukurik, as in Manukurik Nunanak School.
Nanaluk was quick to clarify. She understands more than she speaks, she said. But what she's really proud of is her Yupik dancing. Before she moved to Manukurik about 7 years ago, Nanaluk says she used to practice all the time in her home village of Akiachuk.
It was very different. Over in Akiachuk, we used to practice moves daily and would even prepare for Chamay Festival. And I was only in second grade. And it was awesome.
Nanaluk says now that she's older and living in Manukurik, she wishes she was still practicing dance every day. And Blanchett knows this struggle. He told the group of teenagers, people often tell you that art and music and dance is not important in the way that, say, serving on the school board or city council is important.
But I like to think that it is. It is very important.
When he said that, Nanaluk got this huge smile. She says that's because one of her goals is to be able to perform and travel like Bumua does.
Bumua in Yurok is totally, like, a lot more than student council and stuff like that. I think it's pretty important because it's part of our culture and our ancestors, like, created songs to express their feelings, and it's their culture and art that way.
At the concert, before Bumua played their last song of the night, Blanchett hopped up to do a dance. It took a little encouragement, but soon dozens of people left their seats in the bleachers and went down to join him. They lined up all the way across the gym floor. grown-ups and babies and teenagers, all waving their hands and bobbing their heads and trying to follow along with some of his silly freestyle moves. Mackenzie Nanaluk was front and center. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
A couple of weeks ago on this program, we had a conversation about caribou on the Nooshigak Peninsula. You're probably aware that biologists think that herd is too large for that habitat at the moment. Let's take a moment and talk about how biologists come up with population estimates, but here for moose rather than caribou. Biologists tell us the preferred method in southwest Alaska for counting moose is to fly surveys and spot their dark brown bodies contrasted against the white snow. Now, for anyone who's flown around looking for moose ahead of a hunting effort, perhaps, you know they are not as easy to spot as one might assume. The Togiak Refuge has not been able to update their moose population estimate in a couple of years now, says lead biologist Pat Walsh.
The last time we got a count for the overall refuge was 2011.
And that number was 1,100-ish?
1,166.
Walsh says biologists have been happy with the moose population in the refuge. If anything, at last count, the number for the given habitat was on the large end, which means there has been plenty of hunting opportunity within GMU 17A. But how do you update the population estimate when Mother Nature refuses to offer good snow cover? Walsh and his colleagues at Fish and Wildlife and at Fish and Game have been scratching their heads, rather putting their heads together, to solve that conundrum. Next week, they'll try a new method of counting moose during another low snow or no snow winter. Walsh dropped by our studios this week to explain what that will look like.
We're tailoring methods that have been used elsewhere to our situation here, where basically we know we're missing moose. And so what we're trying to do is estimate how many we're missing. So if we know how many we're missing plus how many we've actually counted, then we have a total population.
And how do you do that then? That's the tricky part, right?
That's the tricky part. And the way that's done is we have 60 moose that have radio collars on them. And if we send our survey crew out to count all the moose they see, and in the course of their survey they see 30 animals with radio collars, then we'll know that they've missed 50% of the radioed moose. And so we can assume they're missing 50% of everything. So if they saw 1,000, then we know the true population is really 2,000.
Now, I'm guessing that you have to do that more than just once. You've got to get some sort of a sample set or some other, whatever the right data term is.
Yeah, that's true. The way I presented it, it's simple and easy, but there's a lot more to it than that and a lot of things that can make it not work. So we'll try to do 40 or 50 sightability trials, and a trial consists of searching for a known radioed moose with a crew that does not know where it is, but there's a telemetry ship, a radio telemetry ship that does know where it is. And each one of those trials will add to a sample size that will allow us to correct the overall estimate.
In order to get the right calculation that you need, will this take weeks or months or several years of trying this procedure to get it accurate?
We're looking at this as a two-year experiment right now to learn just how well we can use this method. And over the course of the next 2 years, we'll run this survey four times, two times in the spring and two times in the fall. And so we'll be working in a broad range of snow conditions, ranging from no snow in October to as good a snow as we can have in March. And so we'll record the various snow conditions and other conditions that affect sightability, such as the habitat that the moose is in and other covariates that will help us determine what percentage we're seeing under what types of snow conditions.
Walsh says it will probably take 80 to 100 hours of flight time over a week to 10 days to get the first set of data. On top of simply spotting moose in these conditions, the survey will depend on the biologist being able to spot the collars on the collared moose. I asked Walsh how exactly the whole thing will work.
Basically, the area is divided up into small survey units, and then each survey crew will be given a number of units to go to on a given day. And they'll be issued those by the survey manager, who will know where these radioed moose are. So the survey crews won't know whether there's a radioed moose in their unit or not. But they'll go there, do their survey, and then report the result. And then between the two aircraft, they'll determine whether they've seen the collared moose or not. One of the complexities here is you could see a collared moose and not see the collar. And so if there's a collared cow with two calves and she's in a lone stand of cottonwoods, and the survey crew finds a cow and two calves in this stand of cottonwoods and doesn't see a collar, then that information has to be translated to the telemetry ship, and then they've got to go verify that, in fact, they did see the right moose, because it's not really seeing the collar that matters. It's seeing the moose. So
interesting.
It's one extra thing that makes it complex to carry this thing out.
Are you confident that this will be a good method to produce good data for the refuge to work off of?
I think it will, but until we actually try it and see what we're getting, I will reserve judgment.
Pat Walsh, lead biologist at the Togiak Refuge. Good luck in this new attempt. Thanks so much.
All right, thanks.
When you hear that Aaron Copeland, you know either someone's trying to sell you beef for dinner or public radio in Alaska is getting ready to cover the last great race on Earth. The poor Iditarod is hampered by terrible trail conditions again, nowhere more so than in its ceremonial starting grounds in Anchorage, which is shipping in snow by train, embarrassingly, for the photo op. That's where Emily Schwing, APRN's now veteran reporter for the 1,000-mile Iditarod race, joins us ahead of tomorrow's start. Emily, thanks for coming on our program.
Sure thing, Dave.
So I was reading Craig Medrid today, and he used some pretty colorful words to describe the quality of the trail. So I suppose that's the first question I'll ask is, what are you hearing people say about the lack of snow?
Well, that is the question that everybody is asking, Dave. What I've heard from the lack of snow is that there is one. here in Anchorage, there's a major lack of snow. There's pretty much nothing on the ground. So they had to reroute the usual 12-mile course, and now it will just be a small 3-mile loop. And they are trucking in snow and delivering snow. And from what I understand, the city has been stockpiling snow for the event. And then after the mushers leave Willow, from what I hear, there's a reasonable amount of snow on the trail, but near what is notoriously known as the burn, there's pretty much no snow on the ground. Things are very windblown between Caltag and Uniloquit, and there's even some issues with the sea ice once they get out on the coast. There's no shore fast sea ice at Uniloquit, so that trail has been rerouted onto land, and it's unclear what's going on with the ice on Gallivan Bay. From there, they head up to Nome, and out in Nome, I can tell you that the wind has been pretty variable, so there are parts of the trail that have snow, and there are parts of the trail that do not.
I suppose it wouldn't be any fun if there weren't some variables to the race, and no doubt the trail will give reporters like yourself plenty to report back on to see the toll that takes. Most importantly, of course, is who's going to do well this year. We've got the CVs, and I think are they the favorites, it seems like. Who's your odds-on favorite? Who do you think is going to do well this year? Who's going to be interesting to watch? What's your prediction?
Well, I never like to make public my top 10. I like to keep my cards close, I guess you could say. You're right in thinking that the CVs are definitely some favorites to watch. I can also say that Brent Sass probably has a very strong dog team, especially because he did not push his dogs as hard as I think he would have liked to in the Yukon Quest last month due to illness, his own, and a bug that was going through his dogs. Some other names to watch: Hugh Neff, this year's Yukon Quest champion, is coming back to the Iditarod, and it seems he's got quite a strong team. And then there are some of our other favorites. Allie Zirkle, Jeff King, Robert Sorley is back after having one in 2003 and 2005. I think he's, you know, a really competitive Norwegian to keep an eye on. We'll see Martin Boozer driving a team again. Pete Kaiser, this year's Kuskokwim 300 champion, will also be racing. There's a lot of finishers who finished in the top 10 and 15 that'll be back, including Travis Beals and Wade Mars, two young guys who are kind of up and coming. Nicholas Petit, he is also someone to watch. He won the Copper Basin this year. And there's one woman in particular, well, actually there's two women in particular, but one in particular that I think gets overlooked, and that's Sigrid Ekron. She is a Norwegian musher. She's been living in Alaska for quite some time and really seriously training her dogs up in the Alaska range this year. She is a world champion. She's won the Finnmarksloppet, which is the longest distance race in Europe. It's held in Norway every year. And I really think that if people wanted to have someone to root for that they didn't expect, it might be, or hadn't given any thought to, I think she might be able to pull off a really nice performance this year.
All right. Well, Emily Schwing, have fun on the trail, and we look forward to the reports. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And good luck to the field of 85 mushers and their teams as they embark on the trail tomorrow. A reminder that APRN will be providing coverage daily from the trail, and we'll have that on the air here starting Monday. That's it for this week's show. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at our website, kdlg.org. I'm Dave Benninger. Keep in touch with feedback and ideas for our news department, and we'll see you back here next week.